Good morning, everyone. I spoke to someone the other day who said she enjoys these talks, but the only thing is the beginning where no speaking is happening for a few minutes. So she said, why don't you get on with it? And so I replied, it has to come. It's not like a deliberate doing. It begins like that. So please bear up with it if you feel too that I should get on with it. There are two things I would like to touch upon briefly before opening up for questions, if any. Just to clear two aspects, very basic aspects, but good pointers on one's own journey towards peace and equanimity. One is related to the talk last week, where a girl was questioning what gives her inner joy. And the other is on pleasure and pain. Both are connected, so I'd like to begin with the latter. Pleasure and pain go hand in hand. They are the polaric ends of the same movement. So if you picture a pendulum swinging from one side to the other, one side that reaches the top is pleasure and the other is pain. When it reaches the point of pain, it has gathered enough momentum to swing back to a high of pleasure and vice versa. This is the swing of life between pleasure and pain that most of us get trapped by. Now, what happens with the understanding is the swing becomes less and less of a swing, which means if your peace of mind becomes less dependent on pleasures, which are transient, then simultaneously, you will not swing to the high of pain that you were swinging to earlier. Pain means suffering. So this swing, when it becomes less and less, and less and less till you come to the still point. So both don't sway you anymore. It cannot be only one-sided. If you say that now my suffering has reduced, my psychological suffering has reduced, it means you are more at peace, which is the midpoint. Therefore, automatically, you will not get swayed by pleasures and peak experiences and high points like you used to earlier. This is very important to understand. Life becomes more neutral. The swinging like a pendulum brings both down to a still point, not only one. So one has to be careful. Because one may think one is suffering less psychologically, but it is not true. Because if one is getting swayed by the peaks of pleasure, then it is quite natural that the same is still happening with psychological suffering. This is the law of life, the law of the pendulum. Both meet in the middle, which one could say is called witnessing. Witnessing the flow of life, that is sometimes pain, sometimes pleasure. Then you are no longer sitting on the ball of the pendulum and getting swung by the movement. Now we come to inner joy. What is inner joy in practical terms? Now, inner joy cannot be inner joy if it depends on an outcome. Because sometimes I get what I want, sometimes I don't get what I want. That is clear. Inner joy cannot depend on an outcome. Therefore, what is true inner joy? True inner joy, as one will discover, cliched as it may sound, is the joy of being without depending upon anything to have that inner joy. Now, there's a wonderful phrase of Aurobindo's, inner joy through works, which means whatever you are doing, Let's say you're an artist and you are painting. Let's say you are skilled in a particular profession and you are practicing that and enjoying doing it through works. Through works means whatever work is happening through you gives you inner joy. How is that possible? One, the outcome is set aside. That is, of course, why in the Gita, Krishna says, forget about the fruits of the work. It is the work itself. A dancer dancing experiences inner joy. Why? Because the me, with its sense of doership, which is the thinking mind, is not operating. The working mind, in the moment, in the now, is what meditation during work or activity means. Because in both cases, meditation, let's say, when one is not doing an activity, so to speak, and meditation at work, when the thinking mind is kept aside, in both cases, the me with its sense of doership is absent. And that is why work gives us this opportunity to bring peace to the work. There's a famous story of a Zen archery monastery. The master would teach archery as a practice. He had many students. Now the master's close friend had been watching when the monastery came up, became very famous, many students came. But one thing he could not figure out. So he went one evening to his friend, the Zen master, and he said, you know, you've done a most beautiful job of this archery school. People love you, your students love you, your name has spread far and wide, but I can't help but say you are not a master of your craft. You yourself are one notch below the best. Now the master knew why he was saying it. Nevertheless, he asked, he said, tell me, my friend, why do you say so? And he said, because every time I have seen you practice, in fact, even with your students sometimes, you don't hit the bullseye all the time. You miss the mark. What is the point in that? What kind of mastery is that? And the master told his friend, he said, I may be missing the mark, but you have missed the point. The point is that the act of archery must be sheer joy for my students, not a goal-oriented practice which builds pressure and tension and anxiety in this quest for perfection. That is what Zen archery is firstly about, at least my vision of Zen archery. I want it to be a meditative practice for my students, which gives them deep joy. And therefore, I have never stressed on the outcome that the arrow must hit the bullseye. And that is how I live my life. Perfection is in the moment, here and now. Ramana Maharshi said, whenever you are working, do not say to yourself, I am doing this work, but rather, the current is working through me. The current that lifts this pressure and this load off one's shoulders. And in both cases, witnessing starts happening more and more and more and more. Witnessing is the gift bestowed by the teaching. It's not even that it is bestowed, you see, because it is one's nature. But that witnessing got so overlaid and covered up with goals to be a better person, to be better at work, with doing all the time, that what came naturally to us, witnessing, turned into observing and judging. And therefore, witnessing is closely linked to inner joy because it does not depend on external objects. I am reminded of another story linked to Alexander the Great. You know, it's quite something that Alexander could not really invade India. His conquests ended here. And apparently he was always with a spiritual and philosophical bent, despite all this conquering. So when he reached India's borders, he asked his soldiers to find a mystic, an Indian mystic, in Taxila was the area. And the most famous one there was someone who was called Dandi Swami, the master with the stick, or Dandamesh. So one of his highest ranking soldiers was sent to Dandamesh, who later Alexander called Dandamis. I'm sure the story is on the net. And so the soldier got down from his horse and told Dandamesh, who was lying on his bed of leaves in the open field. He said, "Get up. Alexander, the son of the great mighty Zeus, wants to see you. I have to take you to him." And Dandi Swami said, "Is it so?" He said, "I feel no need, because even I am the son of the great mighty Zeus." And he said, "I offer you all these gifts and treasures. Why weren't you lured by them?" And he said to Alexander, "What silly things are you talking about? And that too, look at what you're doing with your conquests and conquering. I am willing to come, but let me tell you, I am only interested if you are an emperor of your inner dominion. That is what I'm interested in, not the outer." And so he refused. In fact, Alexander wanted to take him back, but he could not. But then Alexander did succeed in taking back someone called Kal Agninath, the Lord of Time, a master yogi. He took him back with him. And apparently, this master, when he was in his 70s and his health had started failing, he decided to leave the body. And he sent a message to Alexander that, "I'm done now. My role is over." And then he requested the army to build quite a big funeral pyre for him in front of the entire Macedonian army. He removed his clothes, gave away his horse, asked for a garland of flowers, and walked into the burning funeral pyre. And all the records say how astonished the soldiers were, because Kal Agninath didn't even flinch, but just went, sat there peacefully till the flames consumed him. And his last words before doing that were, "Tell Alexander, I will see him in a year's time in Babylon." And that is where and when Alexander died. Witnessing is the gift, the treasure. Alexander made three wishes on his deathbed, which astonished his highest ranking soldiers who were around him. One was, he said, "When I die, please, I don't want my army to carry my coffin. I want the physicians who have treated me to." And they were quite shocked that the soldier of soldiers is saying this. And he asked him, "Why, O Alexander?" He said, "Because I want the world to know that when it's time to go, it is time. And even the best physicians cannot do much about it." So they felt quite dejected, but that was their master's wish. He was only 32 or 33 at the time of his death. The second wish, he said, "All the gold, silver, and precious stones we have acquired should pave the way from here to my burial place. Just toss them onto the road right from here to where I will be buried." And again the soldiers were astonished. "Why, O master?" He said, "Because as I learned from the Indian masters, all these objects are worthless. Where can I take them? There is no use for them." And so that was done. And people are still trying to find, archaeologists are still trying to find that road. And thirdly, of course, he said, as Kal Agninath has requested that when I die, my hand should hang out of my coffin with the palms open. So people can see that the great Alexander is leaving with nothing. All this is our life's experiences. Our own life lessons are to be learned. Okay. If anyone would like to ask something or share anything, we can start that now. Yes, Harish.
Hi, Gautam.
Hello.
Hi. So this was an incident that occurred a few days back. Business has been an issue, and we've been going to work, but there's hardly anything happening. So I was a bit dejected. I was sitting with my family, and they said, "Why don't you take a day off today?" And I was contemplating. So I went to my room, and suddenly on my phone there was a notification that flashed on YouTube. And it was your faith meditation podcast, you know that. And I went through it that moment. It obviously I was healed, and I heard it, and I went to work, and it's okay. But you see, it's like when you see something like this, you're healed for the moment, but you're not integrated. I want to know is that these temporary things that come to me would heal me for that moment. It gives me a great message. And I also see it as a hand of God that somehow at that given moment, this intervention happened. Very grateful. And it's a surrender too for that moment, because wow, it's so miraculous at that moment. You're seeking for an answer and you get it. But that healing is temporary. Why am I not integrated? So I want you to advise or say something to me that I can carry this, not temporarily, but permanently.
Harish, you know, there are some people who don't even get this brief glimpse of temporary relief. They are caught up in the cycle of life. And there are others like you who have glimpsed it. Now, that glimpse is also not in your control. You came across a teaching because it was destiny, right? Now what happens is, because you have seen the value of that glimpse, the relief it has got, the mind comes in and it says, "I want this 24/7, right? That is natural. That is natural because you have seen the value of it, or rather the value of it has been seen. But don't forget that there's decades of hardwired conditioning which has to get peeled away. Transformation is rarely sudden, mostly gradual. So it is just like the glimpses are like getting your driving license. Now you have glimpsed it. You know how to drive, but very briefly. You can take the car out from your building compound to 50 feet away with confidence. But heavy traffic, crowded streets, you are not yet comfortable with. So the driving license becomes the awakening that, oh yes, awakening is awakening out of suffering. I have felt it briefly, I've sensed it, and because I get so much relief, I want more of it. Now that happens when you're driving for the next year or two after having been given your license, and you start seeing that now I'm more and more comfortable driving through crowded streets, when there's heavy traffic, when there's a bus in front of me or on my left, and so on. That is the process of deliverance. So there's awakening and there's deliverance. Deliverance happens when, through this journey of life, life becomes simpler, simpler and simpler and simpler, till one day, let's say 2 years after you got your license, someone said, "Hey, Harish, you went through that most crowded street of Bombay. How did you do it? Because you just got your license 2 years ago." And you said, "Oh my God, you're right. It didn't stress me out as it would have stressed me out 2 years ago. You're so right." Then one knows deliverance has happened. What is deliverance? Awakening functioning in daily living is deliverance. So this is a process. This is a process. It takes time. The intention is pure. The earnestness is there because you have tasted the peace, which perhaps you didn't taste before because you were caught up in so many things. Blame, guilt, condemnation, so on. It's natural that one wants more of it, but it will happen. Just like you could not control this point happening to you. Like you said, the faith meditation popped up. Did you will it?
Yeah.
It happened. That is called grace. What does grace require? Only trust. Only trust. Grace needs only trust. Don't mistrust. Trust.
Would you say this is the purpose of life?
You could say that. Why not? Indeed.
Because we always seek this question, what is my purpose in life? And I see it's actually very simple, but it's so complicated in my mind. So would you say that?
That is precisely why Rameshji would say, and he would say, I'm not joking when I say that the purpose of life is the living of it. The purpose of life is the living of it. You don't know whether you are going to wake up tomorrow. So is a goal-oriented purpose of any use? You may not wake up from your sleep. So the purpose of life is the living of it. He would also sometimes say that the purpose of life is to know that life has no purpose. Now, why was he saying that? Why was he saying something which could be perceived as harsh? That the purpose of life is to know that life has no purpose. Because this ego, which is so driven on doership, sees in its own life, outcomes are not in its control. It cannot control events, situations, so many factors. Sometimes when the ego needs that hit, the purpose of life is that life has no purpose, wakes up. Because even through disturbance, which is again a very Zen practice, sometimes the ego needs to get jolted out of its dream, you see. It's a dream of control. So it's very true what you said. This is it. This is it. Here and now, this is it.
I have such a stubborn ego. I have such a stubborn ego.
I think all egos are stubborn. It's a question of degrees. It's a question of the real stubborn ego, Harish, would not even reach thus far. You see, the real stubborn ego would actually reject this entire teaching. That is a stubborn ego. You know, there are various degrees. It's so beautiful. Last Sunday, we spoke about, I think I was telling Priyam about, consider your glass being half full and not half empty. And someone who's come home a few times, Abhay, he sent me a message saying, I am thankful to God that I even have a glass. Forget it's half full or half empty.
Last Sunday, surrender meditation was brilliant. It was absolutely stunning.
I would like to, for us to be together for more of such meditation.
Oh, it was brilliant. It was awakening, very awakening.
Super. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Anish, thank you. Yes, Kuzali, have I pronounced your name properly?
It's Kurali. It's Kurali.
Kurali.
Yes, so you got it right this time. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, Gautamji, we have gone through years and years and years of conditioning. So, this entire concept of non-doership is so new to me, but I'm slowly taking it in, you know. There are days when I'm completely able to sink into that teaching, and then there are days when I feel, no, I've done all this to people and people have done all this to me. Then again, I have to shake myself and say that, no, I'm not the doer. Nobody else is the doer and things like that. So like Ramesh Balsekar calls it, the flip-flop keeps happening every now and then. But I was just thinking this morning, one of the conditionings has been that whatever part that the parents do is passed on to the children. You know, there is a saying in Tamil which says Mata Pita Seyum Paavam Makkal Thalaiyil, which means the paap that the parents do, the father and the mother do, has to be borne by the child. I just wanted to know, what does Advaita has to say about this?
Sure. The pap, when you say it, means the sins. The sins of the parents have to be borne by the children, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Now, firstly, this is true because the child is conditioned by the parents. The parents are the child's first teachers, right? Hmm. So, in that sense, the sins of the parents have to be borne by the children. But what Advaita says is they are not the doers, you see. This is a very important point because the parents were conditioned by their parents. Now, the easiest conclusion to reach is, oh, that means nobody is responsible. This is not saying anything about that. Now, I'll tell you, take an example of parents who are fear-based in their thinking. I know some parents who are full of fear. They have two children. They have told me that they are full of fear. The parents have told me that. They've always been full of fear. When the children were young, they were afraid, this will happen to my child, that will happen to my child. When the children grew up, don't go out with this boy. Don't go to the beach at this time. So the conditioning was fear-based because naturally their conditioning was fear-based. Now, out of their two children, one child has become so fear-based that he is under medication. He cannot handle it. The other child is fine. What does that mean? The sins of the parents, so to speak, which Advaita has a very different perspective on this word sins, but the conditioning of the parents got passed on to the child and to one child because it was that child's destiny. It was not the other child's destiny to be so affected. The other child is very outgoing, very carefree, very like adventurous. You see, so there are karmic equations, there are karmic blueprints. Everyone comes with their destiny. Everyone comes with their destiny. So firstly, one cannot blame one's parents for doing certain things. It could be blame arises in the moment that why did you do this to me? Why didn't you love me enough? So on and so forth. But the fact is that every human being comes with their conditioning, including one's parents. It is the destiny of some people, could be the parent, could be the child, where the spiritual dimension opens up and all the resentment, blame that, let's say the child was carrying towards a parent, the child now sees this in a different light, that this is how it is. This is actually what I have understood, that my parent could really not help it. And that flowering is the understanding where relationships, in this case, a karmic parent-child relationship, is seen in a different light. Otherwise, what happens? Hardwired condemnation, blame, and resentment goes on and on and on. There are people who have resented their parents right till the parents' death. You won't believe it. I will tell you, in Rameshji's time, I made many friends there from all over the world who would come. Now, I was about maybe 30 and this man was about 55, let's say, 50, 55. Very wealthy, extremely wealthy. He was the heir to a large fortune, And who was standing in the way was his mother. The father wanted to give him the large fortune. The mother was standing in the way. And the reason was these two did not get along. The son hated the mother, and the mother, I don't know if she hated the child, but why I say the son hated the mother, you'll be so surprised. It was, you know, Valentine's Day, 14th Feb or something, I don't know. We were having coffee somewhere and I said, oh, you know, somehow this whole thing of Valentine's Day came up and all that. And he said, why? I see in India, sometimes everyone is wishing everyone happy Valentine's Day. Children are wishing their parents and it's all like my staff members wish each other. I said, yeah, this is India. It is like that, you know, it's just like that. So I told him, I said, you call your mom and wish her happy Valentine's Day. He said, are you crazy? I'd rather gift her a bomb. And I thought he was joking. I thought, come on, don't joke like this. Don't say such things. He said, I'm not joking. I hate my mother. I hate her. And at that time, if he was 55, how old must his mother be? Close to her 80s at the least. You see, so where do we carry this? Where do we carry this? This doership can become a very heavy burden.
Very true, Rami, Gautamji. In fact, I've had a very abusive childhood from my mother. And all my life, I thought, you know, I should never become like my mother. I should have a very healthy relationship with my sons. And thanks to your teachings, since, you know, July 5th, Guru Purnima Day, I've now come to accept that my mother was just destined to do what she did, and she did not have an agenda to spoil, you know, my life, or she did not have an agenda to ruin my childhood. It was just destined to happen through her. So it has been quite liberating. It is still work in progress, but, you know, I at least have started to have that outlook.
Yes, I can.
You know, it was destined to happen through her.
It is.
So thank you so much for these teachings.
Family relationships are the most karmic, because we've come with that, you see. As the saying goes, you can't choose your family, but you can choose your friends, which actually you can't choose your friends either, but one understands the sentiment behind that. Now, the whole point is, raise such an important point. The action-reaction loop is what is the bondage of relationships. And supposing one is in an abusive relationship, what happens is that action-reaction loop keeps perpetuating itself, and the karma gets reborn every time. You did this to me, I will do this to you. You said this to me, I say this to you. That is the karma perpetuating. The break from this cycle is not happening. Why? Because one has not accepted the basic tenets that we are all instruments through whom God's will functions. All relationships are on account of Rinanubandhan and are destined. And all we can bring to the situation is our attitude to life, to relationships, because it is our attitude that determines our peace and equanimity. And when these relationships get healed with this new perspective, the Rinanubandhan starts dissolving. The Rinanubandhan starts breaking up. That is the gift. That is the gift of it. It is not, I repeat, it is not a license for people to be abusive, because that in fact reflects a lack of understanding. If you had the acceptance that the same consciousness functions through everyone, you could not be abusive to another, you see. So that understanding is not there on the parent's part, but it can be on the child's part if it is the child's destiny. That is what happens. The awareness comes in by grace. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Gautamji, good morning. I'm Kureli's husband. My name is Srinivas. Just a follow-up question on that, right? We're talking about all these teachings at a very serious issues in life. I have a very simple question. We have two boys. They're very playful right now. You know, they're indoors. They're on the games always, etc. On a daily basis, right? We tell them to study for some time. You also enjoy. We are very reasonable from our perspective, but they see us very differently. So there is a kind of trigger always happening on a daily basis. So even these things are destined to do, or is there anything that we can do as a parents without spoiling anybody's peace?
No, you are absolutely right. It's such a common question that is asked. The main thing, Srinivas, is A, you have to do precisely that which you think and feel you should do, because you are the parent. You know what you feel is best for the boys. But right. Now the understanding comes that despite my saying things, whether or not they follow it, destiny. So that pressure comes off you and it comes off them. Otherwise, what happens? You keep repeating yourself, you keep badgering. You see, that's what the ego does. It tries to force its way through. It tries to force its opinion. It tries to force things to happen, that is a form of violence. So what happens with the understanding that you know now, that all I can do is request them, show them the way based on my conditioning, what I feel is right and wrong. But now I know that when it has to sink in, it will sink in. When it's meant to happen, it will happen. So that lifts the burden from this dynamic, you see. That is again the gift of the teaching. Because now you rest in that knowing that everything has its time. When it is meant to happen, it will happen. And then neither the child feels the pressure, nor the parent feels the pressure. That is what starts happening.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dabandi.
Okay. Thank
like
you.
Ramesh G says, you know, the programming is such. So that's what I tell him. You know, they've been programmed like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's it.
Thank you so much.
Yes, Priyam, welcome back.
Good morning, sir. And hello. Thank you so much for today's satsang. I wanted to thank you because after last Sunday's session, four people reached out to me just to thank me for asking the question and also to say that you are not alone. And that really made me feel connected. So I would like to thank you for that. And also the theme of this week has been mostly just trying to be a witness. So I observed this, that if I'm sitting in my room and I'm painting, or if I'm sitting in meditation or reading or something, it very effortlessly comes to me that there is no separate self. Action is happening and there is just some consciousness which is just looking at it. So there is no localized separate entity called Priyam, which is doing that. And it came effortlessly to me several times throughout the week. But I also saw that once I leave my room and I have to interact with the world, then you have to pick up this personality. And now you have to function as this Priyam person. And there is this forgetting sometimes that you are functionally just, you'd have to functionally be Priyam in the world, but you are not this. So there is this like, I observe that there is still a lack of that remembrance. So I tried to do that this time, that the body is karmically going through experiences, but it's not me. It's not, because there is no separate point in the body or mind where I can say, yeah, this is me and this is... So this week it was increased level of seeing that I could even detach myself from a situation and smile and see, yeah, okay, this arose. For example, one girl who reached out to me after the session told me that she has met you in person. And there was this pang of like, I want that. There was this desire that I want to be in person and be in a satsang where you are there, like physically present. But then there was this realization that if that has to happen, that will happen. So desire will arise in this body and you just don't have to be attached to the outcome. Even if it doesn't manifest, you don't really have to attach your happiness with that. So this week was interesting in terms of these realizations and it's still up and down. But mostly it's like there is no me even, so there's nothing happening and... So there was more confidence also. For example, I'm a very passive person. So once the rent and bills are done for the month, I would rather just sit in my room and do nothing. So to the world, that is being lazy. To the world, that is being not ambitious enough. So, but now I kind of was very happy with it. I was like, this is what is naturally coming to me. So there was no conflict of, I should be doing more. I should not be just wasting my time like that. So overall, it was a very aware sort of a week. And I would so like to thank you for that because there is this communion with you where you feel like a friend and it's not some esoteric high level teachings, which I don't understand. It's coming from someone who has seen the plight of being human and makes us understand in such compassionate way. So I don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you.
So Priyam, there are two things. One is that, it is a fact that we are people, we are a person in daily living. We are not that we all are in any case, but we have to operate as a human being. So that is why this point was always emphasized by Rameshji, you know, that you are the person. When Priyam is called, she is going to answer. The whole point is the sense of doership which Priyam carries. Now, based on your last week's sharing, I would like to ask you something because it stayed with me. You said that because of your experiences of loss, and you referred to your parents and you referred to your brother and so on, that now you tell everyone you meet sorry, right? Now, I would like to ask you that when you do that, is it after you have said or done something that you feel it may not be right and you say sorry, or do you just say sorry to everyone? Can you elaborate on that, please?
There is this heightened sense of consciously or unconsciously, I might have done something to hurt you and that was not my intention. That is what happened through me in that moment, but I would still like to apologize because I could have maybe exercised better judgment and be more conscious of what I say or do to you.
But
because
do you
everyone, even there are some incidents in life which happen naturally because that they are destined to happen. For example, death, loss, health problems and stuff like that, that is destined to happen. That's natural. But on top of that, we also meet people who kind of like karmically or something, we are left with bitter experiences. So it's like already life has given you these natural causes of suffering. And on top of that, you will also meet humans which might cause suffering, even though they didn't intend to. So I, at one point, just couldn't understand that how come every friendship or everything just leads to a big, as if somebody is just telling me that this is not your path, like engaging and expecting anything out of other humans is not your path. And you shouldn't really just get attached to people and form friendships and stuff. So then I started getting so fearful of any interaction that I started saying, I don't know what have I done to you in past life, because it is coming back to me in such heightened pain way. So I just say sorry, like, I don't know what have I done to hurt you or something like that. So, yeah.
So PMC, the thing is that the journey of life is the journey of life. There's no question of this is not your path, that is not your path. Those are all people saying such things. Okay?
Uh-huh.
You are on life's journey. Now, supposing God came to you, stood in front of you and said, dear Priyam, my dearest Priyam, I know your past experiences have been of loss, but do me one favor, Priyam. Right now, all this feeling that I may have done something which has hurt people, I may have said something and so on, just put all this on the ground before me. Unburden yourself, because you are my child. You are precisely the way I have made you. So why are you carrying this burden of guilt and shame that maybe people don't like me because of what I'm doing, what I'm saying? Right now, put this entire burden down in front of you on the ground. I am going to take it. Be free of it. Don't blame yourself. Don't judge yourself. Don't hate yourself. Accept you are precisely the way God has made you. I have made you. If something happens going forward and regret arises in a particular relationship, by all means, talk to that person and say, I didn't mean to, I'm sorry it happened. But don't make this the default rule of life in your relationships that you have to go about being sorry. Please. You are beautiful the way you are. Everyone's life is like this. Nobody is perfect. We all have some harmonious relationships. Some are not harmonious. That is the nature of life. We like some people more than we like others. That is the nature of life. It has to be accepted. But why this role of playing the victim? I must have done something I should not have done. That is the ego with its sense of doership. So drop it all right now in front of you. Be free of this and let this beautiful light shine where you do your paintings, where you express happiness through whatever gives you happiness. Let it now radiate. Now you know that life means experiences. In your case, there have been many painful ones. So that you have seen. So don't let this now burden you to the extent where you feel that you are responsible for all that has happened to you. It is not like that.
Okay.
Let it go. Because what can happen is one can end up hating oneself. How can consciousness hate itself? Only through a misunderstanding that I might be doing things. When you spoke about companionship last time, about wanting to be loved, what is wrong with that? I don't know which teachings say you should not, you should be on your own, you should first have your own this, your own that. That is all conceptual baggage. What arises naturally is fine. And you see, with this understanding, with the teaching, what happens is one's nature becomes loving. When you are freed of this burden of separation and hatred and malice and jealousy and envy and pride and arrogance and guilt and shame and blame and condemnation and so on, one naturally becomes more loving. Loving in what sense? Not as an individual to an individual. As one's nature, compassionate, as the Buddha would call it. Compassion arises when you see others suffering. So that becomes more of a quality of one's own life. That is what changes. That is what shifts. And that loving has to include oneself also. It's not about loving others.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Is there anything else you would like to share or add?
No. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care. Thank you for coming back. Yes, Shibashish.
Hello, sir. It's so good to see you.
Tell me.
I was, it's just that I've never been a part of a satsang before. Like, of course, I was a part of your satsang 2 weeks back. I was fortunate enough to watch your last video on YouTube. I miscalculated my dates, actually. I was prepared to attend it. And for some reason, I thought that it was a Saturday while it was a Sunday, and I was working, and I was like, oh, they're already live and I couldn't join it. So, but thankfully it was on YouTube, so I could watch it live there.
Right.
And it's amazing, like the amount of acceptance that you have. Sometimes I really wonder that by the time, you know, when a question arises, by the time you unmute me, half of it seems to be answered, and a part of my mind knows what you probably will say. And then and with that thought that I know that probably he's going to say this, and then I think, should I even ask that? And so I was simply saying, if I were to take that into account, that you know, since again I keep referring to the music business because I'm a part of it, and how this seems very shallow, but it is what it is, and I can't really, you know, I don't want to engage in the act of suppression and say that no, I'm very pure in this or something, because I think that there is a sense of validation that I keep seeking from a very young age, and it's always the need to feel special or need to be told that, hey, you did the right thing, Shibashish. It's because I didn't grow up in that environment where I was of course very encouraged to do what I was doing, but people around me sort of were never really, you know, very welcoming or thought very highly of me, one can say that. And it's only after I achieved a bit of, you know, so my maybe in some would say a bit of identity in this business, that those same relatives took a different notice of me. And that's when it hit me. I was like, was I doing it for them? Because the day I realized that, so I have proved my worth, and I felt really hollow. I felt very, very bad. I was like, but I loved doing this. And from that moment, I was like, so what am I supposed to do now? Because now that I know that I can do it, who am I? And even for a spiritual teaching, I fear that who is talking? Because once the sense of doership sort of grabs hold of a teaching, it becomes very difficult to understand whether it's me or it's the ego. And that's the time when I start thinking, probably Sir would say this, probably Eckhart would say this, probably Rameshji would say this. And I know the answers, but I just know them on the level of words. I haven't lived them. And I don't want to do it because they have said it, because that again beats the point. It's like me, it's like my ego saying, let's do this because you will achieve a sense of relief or a sense of success. So I constantly feel that I lack conviction the way I would perhaps want to have conviction. And maybe that's also ego thought, I don't know. That's question one. What do you have to say about conviction? I know what is faith, but maybe in a way you explain that I somehow understand it. And number two is that there are people who are very popular but I find that it is more of an egoic reaction to the world or how they process their craft. It's more like, I think they celebrate the sense of doership, and I think that sort of works very well with people on an average, because again, that has a mass appeal. Saying something like even if we go through the lyrics of any songs, it's always like, "Maine ye kiya hai, I did this, I can love you so much." So there's a sense of doership in everything. And even that famous, that one piece of dialogue which got very famous in my generation, that from that film, where it was a Paulo Coelho dialogue, which was translated in Hindi, ki, what is seeking you, what you are seeking is seeking you, and agar dil se kuch chaho to the universe sets it to you. But you see how it's always like, you can do this. It's very capitalistic and very consumerist perspective. And I just can't help wonder that, do I have to use that too? Because I feel left out, to be very honest, because what is around me right now, I don't belong with either of their thoughts. And the practical problem of that is that they do not open up to me. They come to me, of course. I was working on a short film, I completed the work. They come to me, but it's not the same thing. They know that this boy doesn't think like we do. So it's always, so I don't know, I feel left out. So these are the two questions, actually, the lack of conviction and this thing. Yes. I'm sorry to everybody else. I know this is a very elaborate question. I'm sorry if I'm holding anybody up. You feel free to not answer this. We can go back. It's fine.
I may not answer the way you are hoping that I answer, but I will answer.
Of course. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
One thing to clarify is this, regarding the sense of doership and one's practical experience in daily living. If there is a musician on a stage performing, of course, pleasure will arise if the performance is applauded. That is human nature. Pleasure is bound to arise. You're not a zombie sitting up there and playing and saying, I don't need anyone's validation and I don't care if they applaud or not. But that pleasure will not turn into pride. I did this. I am so great that people are standing up and applauding. Because the man of understanding, the musician of understanding now knows that all these attributes which made me a musician, my childhood, my natural abilities, my natural sense of sound, the way my fingers move, are all God-given attributes. So truly, I am not the doer in that sense, because these gifts were given to me. I worked hard at it because these were available to me. They were not available to everyone. So pleasure is bound to arise, but not pride, because the ego says, I did this, look at me. And if you don't look at me, I will suffer, because I derive my sense of self and my identity from you who look at me. Then I know my true worth. That is the ego with its sense of doership. The musician is playing for the sake of playing. And if it is appreciated, he is happy. But he will not go into a tailspin of depression if his music is criticized, because he will also know, I did my best and it was not appreciated. That is the difference between the understanding and not having the understanding. So it is not really about words. It is not about being cerebral and all that stuff. It is what is one's own lived experience in daily living. This is where the teaching comes. So it could be that a musician is there, not exposed to the teaching, and that musician was feeling pleasure and pride. Look at my action. I did such a great performance that I'm being applauded. Now teaching creeps in and says, hey, look, take it easy. If you look at things, you were gifted the talent, the attributes. Even the hard work you put in was gifted to you because you allowed that space to work hard. Therefore, be careful, because now you know that it is not your action. And that is when this teaching, when it comes in, the musician who is awakened to his true self now realizes the value of the teaching, because the pressure and the stress to perform for a particular result, that diminishes. The burden is lifted from his or her shoulders. And that is called living the teaching. In this case, it is about playing music, but of course it impacts all areas of one's life. So pleasure may arise, but no pride, no arrogance. Arrogance cannot arise in the man of understanding, because he knows deep down, I didn't do it. So conviction, who wants the conviction? If it is your lived experience, where do you need the conviction? Whom are you wanting to convince you to get the conviction? Conviction is also the attribute of the ego, which wants to be convinced. No, I have this view now, please convince me. It is a way of living, and you will know whether you are living that way or not living that way. As simple as that. It is not a function of the thinking mind. It is your own experience. Now, my own teacher, Rameshji, we all knew what he was going to say. Everything is God's will. Yet we would go back to him. Because
absolutely,
he knew it was true, you see. Now, I'll tell you, in my early days, he loved asking me what's happening at work. And whenever I was stressed out, a client was not paying us money or something, once or twice I went to him, I would say, oh, Guruji, this client has not paid. I don't know how to pay salaries. He said, oh, let's see what happens. I said, it's useless going to this man. So I stopped going to him only, because all I would get was, let's see what happens. And everything is God's will. But that became my mantra, you see. I started seeing whatever happens, whether I perceive it as good or bad, it is meant to happen and it is God's will, because it's certainly not my will. So it's God's will. So that became my way of seeing. My default setting was that in any case, and there was an understanding and a teacher who brought that mirror in front of me and said, look here, this is your own life's experience. And I said, oh, quite right, this is what happens. And actually, it must be happening for everyone. That is my first thought was that everyone's life is like this. And so then the way of living, the way of being, became this teaching itself. And in my own case, I can say that it brought tremendous peace, calm, equanimity, and tranquility. So my conviction does not depend on anything except my own life's experience with the teaching.
That I will take that today. My conviction, I think that sort of sums up a lot of my questions. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much, sir.
Yes, Rahul.
Good morning, Gautam. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you.
Gautam, I was just reflecting on your teachings and also Rameshji's teachings, like the only prayer is the prayer of gratitude, you know,
yes.
Instead of praying for something. So I'm really grateful for what has happened in my life. And, you know, it could have been better, but the way I am, the way I'm right now, I'm really happy. Till now I felt I was the one who did it, but you know, reflecting on the thought, on the teaching, it's like things happened and I was just a participant. Events were happening and somehow I ended up here in Germany. But for the past 2 weeks, something has been ticking me off, and it's all the news of injustice that is happening around in the world. You know, crimes that have been perpetuated on innocent people, or let's say this recently an actor died, and new reports are surfacing that it's probably not a suicide angle. You know, things like that tick me off, because I've been in the film industry for about 2 to 3 years when I was a student. And I've seen things happen like that. And it's not only about the film industry, maybe it's something else. And it really ticks me off. It's like, why is this so much injustice? And I know it's God's will, and maybe it's the person in me thinking that this, you know, the ego in me thinking that I think I'm better at something. I'm a better person, so I'm thinking there's injustice happening. I don't know. Is this something wrong with me or?
No, not at all, Rahul. In fact, I think many people would feel this. You're mentioning about this actor's case where it was first called suicide and now it might be a murder. But throughout history, injustice has happened, you see. Persecution has happened. The Crusades were about that. The Inquisitions were about that. It's not something new. It has been the happening of life. Look at what happened with the Holocaust. Same thing, injustice. This is what man is capable of doing, the evil that man is capable of. Now, we can say it is God's will. Why? Because it would not have happened otherwise. The sheer fact it has happened means it was meant to happen. Okay? But why did it happen? Is because of a lack of understanding. Would all these things happen? Would all this persecution, hatred, malice happen if everyone on the planet knew that we are all instruments through whom God's will functions? It would not happen. And that is not the current level of enlightenment, so to speak. So what is perceived as injustice, as something wrongfully being done to somebody else? One is to accept that it was meant to happen. Murders happen. Whether or not the murderer is caught is God's will. There are so many murders which have gone unsolved. Sometimes, Rahul, the wrong person has gone into prison for the murder. We know, we've read about that also, and then released after 25 years. All these things we don't know. We don't know. And so there is nothing wrong with feeling that why is injustice being done? Because we feel if it is done to someone else, we know what it feels, because we must have felt injustice is being done to us at some point in our life. Otherwise, we would not know. But what happens? The acceptance that this is a part of the duality of life. This is the game of life. Just as I'm seeing handicapped children, what wrong have they done and to whom? But then I've seen healthy children, and I've never thanked God for healthy children. I've always pointed fingers at what did they do. So you see, this duality of life is accepted as part of life. And that includes the pain one may feel in the moment. Pain at injustice being done. It includes that. But what happens is you don't build a story around it. The thinking mind does not go on and on like a stuck machine and builds this whole story, which goes into a loop after loop after loop and then pulls you down. Sorry. So that is what happens with the teaching. It is not that these feelings will not arise, because someone sensitive is bound to feel it. You see, when you see things happening to others which are painful, you are bound to feel it if you're made that way by God. Others don't feel it. For others, it's a news item on the TV. For Rahul, it's not just a news item. Why? Because he's been in the film industry. He's seen things. So that is how things are. So it is not about, am I right? Am I wrong? Do I have the understanding? Do I don't? It is natural. It is a natural. Anything natural is what is meant to be. But now you know, whether or not it is a suicide or murder, whether or not, even if it is a murder, will the right people go behind bars, will the wrong people go? I don't know. How can I know? All I know now is what is meant to happen will happen. I know that I feel that injustice has been done. I know that. I accept my feeling. So this acceptance cuts off the involvement of the thinking mind in these situations. That is what happens. That is the gift of the teaching. I hope that answers your question.
If the problem with me is it takes time to sink in, so I will. So, thank you so much, Yautamji.
It's not really a problem as such, because everything takes time to sink in. Because don't forget, Rahul, we have been bombarded with conditioning since childhood. So anything new which comes in is fresh conditioning. Now that fresh conditioning can be accepted or it can be rejected. If it is accepted, it can be accepted immediately, or it can be accepted over a period of time, but yet it can be accepted. Which of these happens is God's will. And that is why Nisargadatta Maharaj would tell people who were into social causes and activism and all that, he said, first sort out your internal environment, then worry about the external environment. First sort that out. You see, so that was a very important pointer that he gave, because truly the world is a reflection of yourself. It's so simple. Okay. We have time.
Thank you.
Yes, one last one.
Yeah, Gautamji, this is Srinivas.
Yes,
okay, please. I mean, listening to all these questions, I mean, popped up a question, right? What is your views on astrology?
My views on astrology are that it's an ancient science. And however, it depends on the capability of the astrologer, okay. You see. So most definitely it is anything which comes from such a distant past has to have relevance and meaning. And I have said this many times before, though I don't want to go into it now because we are at the end of the talk. In an ancient Indian Gurukul system, the gurus would look at the horoscopes of the child to see the aptitude of the child and then decide on the course of the study, seeing the aptitude. That is how the science of astrology was used. What a beautiful science it is. Unfortunately now, it's all about just predictions. But
yes.
All these esoteric sciences, you see, they were used with meaning. And the child was put on the right track based on the child's nature. All children are not born cerebral. And you know how our system in our time was, you had to max the exams and get 90% and above. What a flawed factory output is what was structured, you know. Everyone is gifted with different attributes. So astrology helped to a large degree with these kind of aspects. So I don't run down all these sciences at all, like many people do, because I have even worked on some of these, like the tarot system in the West. I worked on because of a project which we did, which I mentioned last time, but I could see how the subconscious mind gets totally exposed through tarot cards, and it shows a lot about one's own personality and thinking. In the past couple of decades, what has happened is this has all become like a tool to make money and predictions and all that stuff. That was just one aspect of these sciences. And since you've asked this question, I don't know if you're aware, but one, I'm not a poet and I write terrible poetry, but I wrote something called The World's Best Astrologer, and there's a YouTube video of it. So
sure,
if you
definitely I'll watch.
If you put my name on YouTube and The World's Best Astrologer, you might, either you will enjoy what is written there or you might just hate it.
No, I'll definitely watch it. Thank you so much.
I read it on your page last week. It was beautiful.
Okay. So we'll just sit in silence for a few minutes.
Sure.
And I'll change the view so I can see all of you.